Welcome to Lecture 7 of Marketing 2510 Principles of Marketing. It's September 21st. Tomorrow is the first day of autumn. The high today is what? 88. Okay. So who doesn't have any idea what I'm goofing with in the bottom left-hand side of this screen? Don't know what I'm doing. Who does know what I'm doing in the bottom left-hand side of this screen? So I'm going to get in trouble for what I'm going to say here in a minute. Half the American population, by definition, is below average intelligence. Average is the midpoint. Half has to be below, right? That's definitional. I'm not sure which half has been following this YouTube video joke idea that this guy put up to cook chicken in NyQuil. But apparently a whole bunch of people have been doing it and getting sick. So I share with you, don't put beans in your ears, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, and don't cook your chicken in NyQuil just because TikTok says it'd be fun as a joke to do it. Don't do that. Did anybody cook their chicken in NyQuil? You did. Right. So we've seen this before. Be smart. See this guy? Sign up for the October 12th event. We've seen this. Help out the community. Donate a shirt and go to the event. Test results for mini test 3. Well, I can't give them to you yet because it closes on Saturday. So go and do mini test 3. As you know, I'm not going to do any proctoring for mini test 3 for reasons we've talked about. Enhanced learning extra credit and pack back number 1 close tonight at 11:59 p.m. If you want to earn those extra credit points, either go off and do the enhanced learning extra credit that comes with McGraw-Hill Connect that you got because you stayed with Flashbooks, or go and ask one interesting question and answer 2 interesting questions on PackBack because you decided to go that route for your extra credit points. Any questions on that? So this is sort of, we don't often get an update on the news stories we're doing, but this was sort of an interesting update. How did Thursday Night Football work out for Amazon Prime? So we talked about that last week, I think before it happened on Wednesday. Here it is, having happened. So Thursday Night Football draws record Prime subscriptions for Amazon. How many of you or your folks are Amazon Prime members? Holy molies. Did anyone's family or you join just because of Thursday Night Football? You or your family? You, anybody else? You or your family? You did. How about Webby's? Any of you got? Okay, a couple there too. So you got in on the excitement, right? So Amazon's media deal with the NFL is already paying off for them. Here's the outcomes of their decision, of their business decision. Prime Video broadcast its first Thursday Night Football game last week as a part of an exclusive 11-year deal worth an annual $1 billion we talked about. The game, which saw the Kansas City Chiefs outduel the Los Angeles Chargers, fetched a record number of Prime subscriptions. According to a staff note from Jay Marine, Amazon's vice president in charge of Prime Video, so we reached our audience. The game brought in more Prime signups over a 3-hour period than any other day, including Cyber Monday, Black Friday, and Prime Day. I would say they must understand their target audience and be attracting them in as viewers and subscribers. Prime costs $139 annually. Marine also said the game drew a record primetime audience for the service in the U.S. Amazon was targeting 12.5 million viewers per game. Thursday Night Football averaged 13.2 million viewers last season on Fox. While we're still waiting for the official Nielsen ratings, how many people have heard of that term before, Nielsen ratings? Nielsen, it's a marketing research company that provides, among other things, data on media and media usage. Our measurement shows that the audience numbers exceeded all of our expectations for viewership. So here's important information for your advertisers, because now you can go and say, we had this many million people, you got to pay to be, you know, to be an advertiser on our events. Amazon has a 3-year deal with Nielsen, that's the market research company, which marks the first time that Nielsen would include ratings from a streaming service in its weekly television viewing report. So the importance of marketing research and the importance of staying up with the changing ways of doing business, in this case including streaming service as part of your data flow. YouTube confronts TikTok challenge with its best weapon, cash for creators. YouTube is fighting back against TikTok using the video giant's key advantage. They got money. So we're seeing competition in this industry, in the social media networking industry. We talked about competition last time. On Tuesday, YouTube announced plans to share advertising sales with creators of Shorts, its bite-sized video features. How many guys, anybody still use YouTube? Any of you young folks? Okay. And do you watch those Shorts as they scroll through and you see bears walking around or people? No? Yeah, I find it amusing. I must be the target audience. So, unlike on YouTube's main site, the new program will compensate creators using a pool of funds that's similar to the way TikTok pays its popular stars. So we're getting our creative partners' attention by paying them. Creators can join whether they want to be the next big thing or just need help paying the bills, says Nee Mohan, the company's chief product officer. We want YouTube to be the place that gives them the greatest support in the digital landscape. Better than TikTok, of course. YouTube, part of Alphabet Inc.'s Google, is facing competition from TikTok for both young viewers and the online stars that make the video platform a commercial success. So again, competition. Pay attention. They're taking your customers if you don't pay attention. Sharing revenue is both YouTube's most tangible response to TikTok and its most time-honored. TikTok took off in the U.S. during the pandemic, has regularly impacted pop culture and music since then, and now claims more than a billion users watching endless streams of video tidbits lasting from 15 to 60 seconds. So here's the impact of the pandemic on business, and then turning it around, the impact of business on culture as we go back and forth between these entities. In response to TikTok's rapid rise, YouTube and Meta's Facebook and Instagram all launched short-form platforms that have also grown quickly. YouTube said Tuesday that Shorts is receiving 30 billion views a month from 1.5 billion logged-in viewers. So again, a new product out there to fight the competition, TikTok. Advertising on short form is a little different than with longer form projects. You can't very well attach a 30-second ad to a 14-second short and expect audiences to stick around. So the monetary structure is different too. So here's a bit about, as a marketer, what media are you going to select and how are you going to get to the consumer? What are you going to have to say? What's it going to cost? Instead of the 55% revenue share that YouTube pays for long form creators for the ads attached to their pieces, all short-term revenues will go into a pool each month with qualified creators receiving their proportionate piece of a 45% share of the ad revenue based on the views of their work. The announcement marks a big shift in the DNA of YouTube, which debuted 17 years ago as a place where, as Wojcicki put it, it was mostly cats on skateboards and things like that. The company is now one of the world's biggest ad-supported streaming video services, but also has a huge presence in live streaming. Adding short form in a notable way to its business structure marks another significant shift in what YouTube is, but still fits into a much bigger picture. So here's a corporate growth strategy through developing a new product in this domain. I don't often get, how many people are fashion students? How many people are either sports management or interested in sports students? I don't often get to mix the two together, but I found a nice example that mixes the two together up at the recent New York Fashion Week. Spring Studios is an ad agency who's endeavoring to get attention for itself and for its clients, and MGI unite tennis with New York Fashion Week. With the intersection of sports and fashion at the forefront of both industries, the versatility in clothing has never been more meaningful to those on both on and off the court. So here's trends that this agency and industry is paying attention to. Bringing together fashion and tennis for a triumphant match, IMG Fashion Events and Spring Studios, the creative agency for fashion, beauty, and culture, served customers an immersive experience at something called Glam Slam during Fashion Week. So we have the consumer experience. Taking place during New York Fashion Week, the team collaborated with Chase Sapphire to develop a unique program that spans both the fashion and sports worlds. So we're seeing a bit about sponsorships with Chase, partners in marketing. The experience celebrated the intersection of tennis and style by featuring a full-size tennis court on which they held a series of programming highlights that highlighted the connection between fashion and tennis. Just in time for the big fashion event, the biggest fashion event in the country, as well as the US Open. So events and marketing. Glam Slam featured 5 days of screenings, fashion presentations, limited merch opportunities, and collaborations allowing consumers to experience an exclusive slice of both tennis and fashion. The Glam Slam lineup included IGM Tennis, a division of WME Sports, Maria Sharapova, Serena Williams, other tennis stars, along with the fashion industry's most stylish tennis enthusiasts, including Laura Brown, Cynthia Rowley, and Mason Kitsune. So the use of celebrities. Here's one quick example of how this came together on their tennis court, where they had presenters talking, but also, of course, consumers participating.
I'll say, Olympia, which color do you like better? Or which dress do you like better? And she'll say that one. And I'm not sure if she's just pointing at one because she wants to play games after that, or, you know, yeah, so.
Okay, not the most exciting thing in the world, but if you were there, it was probably cool. She's doing fashion. She's a tennis star. You're out there on a presentation tennis court. Cool. In addition to a variety of brand activations from brand partners like Chase and DraftKings, those things help flesh out the experience beyond clothing, so we see other brand partners in this event. Gregory Azmatsandier, president of North America at the Spring Studios Advertising Agency, said, "We are very much focusing on mixing fashion with luxury and want to create an experience for consumers. It's about creating an experience that's going to fit with the vision of the brand, the audience they want to target, and to innovate, create, and bring culture to the forefront." So here's the ad agency's view of its mission and marketing, and you see magic words that we talk about, the fit, targeting, innovation, bringing value to the consumer. All right, so marketing in the news, it's everywhere. So we pick up with lecture notes, page 65, page 105 in the textbook. And we were in Stone Chapter 4 talking about ethics, and we ended up with the idea of proper criticism for deceptive practices. And while I begged off of some of the criticism doing with pricing, explaining that the price is there for a reason, there's no defending people that are being acting bad, being deceptive. All right, so that's where we are. Another type of deceptive practice we see is deceptive packaging. So we can exaggerate package contents through subtle design, using mislabeling, for example, bad food labels. One of these is more deceptive than the other. If I say my product has no nuts and it does, is non-dairy and it is gluten-free and it isn't, that's just bad, bad behavior. I'm not quite as concerned about myself about them having a candy bar that, quote, fits in the vending machine, and it's this big because it works better in the vending machine rather than being this big, but the candy bar inside isn't full size to the package. But on the package, it says it's 0.75 ounces. You can read that if you want to read that. You might choose whether you see that's deceptive or not, but some stuff is clearly wrong. People are just lying to you versus packaging contents. On the other hand, in the domain of packaging, we can get a little deceptive. You guys have been to the grocery store, maybe seen these little cherry tomatoes, whatever they call them, cherry tomatoes, yeah? You've seen something like that? That looks legit, right? Looks like you're going to get a nice container of tomatoes. Let's open up the container. That's what's inside that. You can see that might be considered perhaps by some to be deceptive packaging. And in the middle here is a big hump, which I guess they could claim protected the product, but they sure didn't do much to show you that that was there with their labeling. All right? We might say that that's pushing credibility about being honest versus deceptive. Deceptive practices in general, we talked about a bunch of stuff, lead to legislation. When you can't police yourself, when problems come up, you're just inviting legislators to start making rules that will rule your life. Better not to lie, cheat, or steal in business so that you don't have them setting your rules. But it does lead to this stuff. In its day, a long time ago, Fleischmann's yeast made outrageous claims about what it could do. among other things, they claimed that the yeast would straighten your crooked teeth. I think we'd all agree that's just plain crooked. It ain't a thing, right? As a result of this and this sort of thing, we ended up with the Wheeler-Lee Act of 1938, which gave the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, power to regulate unfair or deceptive acts or practices. So if you don't want government in your lives, don't give them reasons to get there by lying, cheating, and stealing. They can also lead to fines. We heard about a bunch of fines earlier on the other day. Apple agreed to pay $113 million to 34 states for purposefully slowing down the batteries in their older iPhones. They downloaded software to slow down your battery. What? Now, we do sometimes get into another area that people ask about. You've heard of the term puffery, ad puffery, puff. So is puffery deceptive? So as a legal term, puffery refers to promotional statements and claims that express subjective rather than objective views, such that no reasonable person would take them literally. I will point out that if we're doing global law, which we're not, man, in some countries of the world, they're way cracked down on this sort of stuff. Puff is illegal. In the U.S., puffery's okay. Let's think of an example. I say, come to Larry's Coffee in Kent, Ohio, for the greatest cup of coffee in the world. And it probably isn't. Is that deceptive? Or is it puff? And why? Deceptive or puff? Yo.
I think that's puffery.
You think that that's puffery, and so far I'll agree. Why is it puffery? It is something. It is just something you say. Would you agree?
And it's like you can't really judge it.
But what about from the definition of puffery? What would make it puffery, not deception? There you go. You and I could both taste a cup of coffee, and I could say, "By God, that's the best cup of coffee in the world." I'm Larry, of course. That's the best cup of coffee in the world, and you would disagree, right? By the way, would most reasonable people believe that the best cup of coffee in the world is in Larry's Coffee Shop in Kent, Ohio? Probably not. Most people would probably say, "Yeah, that's what people say." Let's try a different example. I say, "Come to Larry's Coffee in Kent, Ohio, for the least expensive cup of coffee in Ohio." And it isn't. Is that puffery or is that deception? And why? You.
Deception?
It's an objective fact. We can actually determine whether or not my cup of coffee is the cheapest in Ohio. Is it reasonable to believe that somewhere in Ohio they have the cheapest cup of coffee in Ohio? Yeah, could be mine. So a reasonable person could believe it. It's an objective fact, and it's either true or not. If it's not true, you're lying. You're being deceptive. Puff is good, or at least okay. Deception, not good. As I wander around my travels, I find things that touch on this issue. So here is Crust 54, the best pizza in the city. Follow this truck for the best chopped liver in New York. This one says Ocean's Market, the best donuts on the beach. This one, however, in Gibraltar, hedges themselves, which I like. Probably the best fish and chips in Gibraltar. Probably. So they play with it different ways as marketers. Yeah? Of course, to the extent you're lying, you're being harmful. You're harming the buyers who think they're getting the cheapest cup, the best cup of coffee, whatever it is. And you also can be harming other business people. You're lying about your accounting practices and saying you're market share is better than it is, your stock's higher than it, whatever. And that's harming competition as they try to compete against you. So it's bad for all those reasons. High pressure selling, another area in which marketers get criticized. Some people are trained to deliver smooth, canned talks to entice purchase. Has anybody had a job like that where you have a canned sales pitch? As long as you are not convincing people to buy stuff they just don't need and half the time isn't any good, like, I guess I'll pick on the siding industry, the siding on your house, you got to decide right now. That's a problem. But high pressure sales using this canned sealed approach persuades people to buy goods that they have no intent of buying, don't need, don't want, don't provide value to them. High pressure selling can occur because maybe we're giving our prizes to our top salespeople, sort of like the mistake Wells Fargo made by setting outrageous caps, outrageous goals for their bank managers. Here you're setting goals and pressuring your salespeople to make sales. It does happen, but fortunately, it's not standard business practice. And obviously, selling people something they have no intent of buying, don't have any need for, and is not a good value for them is not a good way to have long-term relationships. So a bit of canned selling, sure, that's fine. To pressure people to buy stuff they don't need, want, or desire, not a good thing. Unsafe products, not good. This includes products that are not well made, services that are not performed well, products that in fact deliver little benefit or that may even be harmful. I showed you last time the magical device that was supposed, that they were advertising on television, was supposed to, I forget what, heal your muscles or something. So unsafe products come from manufacturers that just don't care. I don't know what's happened to my voice today. Manufacturers that just don't care. Not good. I don't know if they're purposely trying to cheat you. They just aren't being very... Where's my operations management people? Anybody taking op management as a course? No? Okay, so they should be talking about quality control, doing things right. These guys don't care. Some of them come from the fact that the product production process is very complex. You aren't training your workers very good. They screw up, produce an unsafe product. Poorly trained labor would be part of that, and poor quality control. And of course, the last one is the real issue for me. There are people out there that are just happy to cheat, be dishonest, produce low quality products with substandard materials that may not be safe in themselves, and sell them. That should be criticized. Takata airbag recall, you recall that a while ago. Their airbags on a slew of American cars. They weren't performing properly. They were hurting people. They had a massive recall. It actually hurt car sales. Periodically, we'll find children's jewelry that's made with toxic metals, often out of Asia. Not good. We've heard about the salmonella problems in the food supply. Who comes to mind with that one? Nobody? Salmonella? Yo. The chicken farm? Yeah, you get it in chicken. Did you guys hear about it a while ago with Chipotle? Yeah. Chipotle was another one. Periodically, these things were on. Chipotle stopped their business and did retraining for a day. A while ago, there was salmonella in peanuts. And we have products made from peanuts that was making people sick, including peanut butter. anybody know a local business who does a lot of peanut butter? Jeff. Sold by? What's the company? Smucker's. I think Smucker's does Jeff. But anyhow, Smucker's sells a lot of peanut butter. Whatever their brand was, wasn't included in this. But guess what? When people hear that peanut butter is making people sick, doesn't matter if you're the brand or not, your sales are going to go down. So that's not a good thing. There's Chipotle and their problems as well. So the Consumer Product Safety Commission, a government agency put into place to help deal with these bad behaviors of people. Their mission is to protect consumers against unreasonable risk of injury by developing voluntary and mandatory standards banning dangerous consumer products, issuing recalls of products that are already on the market, researching potential hazards associated with consumer products. That's the website. So Did you guys hear? I think it was essentially over the pandemic, the problem that our good folks on Peloton, was it Peloton had? The Peloton, not the bike product, but the...
workout bike?
Well, I'm thinking of the other thing, the treadmill. Wasn't it Peloton that had a treadmill that kids and pets were getting caught under and injured? And maybe, I don't know, that didn't help their sales at all. And they put out a product recall on that. We still here after how many years have we been making baby cribs and baby carriages? We still hear recalls on those things. Things are collapsing, cutting off fingers, hurting the kid. We can't figure out how to make those things. We can put somebody on the moon, but we can't build a crib. So this is the agency that's going to watch about it. So this is Tim Appel talking about his view of ethics and safety.
As far as ethics to my business, I feel very strongly that I don't want to put a product out there that's going to cause a customer a problem down the road. If there's an issue with the house that I see that they may not see, I take care of it. I don't paint over it. I fix it right. And with our new homes, for example, you know, there's a lot of dealers that'll just order the so cheapest house they could possibly get. But I found that, you know, you put a couple options in there that the customer would never see when they walk through your model. For example, water shutoffs on the toilets and the faucets versus having to crawl underneath to shut the whole house off. Or center shelves, you know, you open up the cabinets, you don't even think to open up the cabinets when you're walking through a model home. Then you get to move in, you start putting your pots and pans, and there's no center shelves. So, you know, little things like that that we make sure we put in the house because I want 100% referrals. And I don't cover things up. I don't believe in cutting corners. If there's a problem, we fix it right, no matter what the cost is, because I know that person's going to be happy with their house. It's going to be safe and affordable. They're going to come back, and they're going to send referrals back to me. So every decision I make, and I instill that in all my people, if they're making decisions without me, that we need to do it right the first time, no matter what the cost, and it's going to pay dividends in the long run.
Ethics starts at the top. You can't just tell the bottom people to go be ethical. Works its way down through the system. Your frontline people know don't screw the consumer. Do what's right. And if it's wrong, fix it and make it right. You get referrals, you get satisfied customers, and you aren't in trouble with the law. Planned obsolescence. This is the idea that products need to be replaced before they really should be because technology changes new products and make them obsolete. It includes producers who influence consumers with concepts of changing acceptable styles that change. Anybody think of an industry where we see that a lot?
Cell phones.
Cell phones for the first one.
Ours?
Well, if you would say ours in particular, I don't know if you mean ours marketing.
I don't know which car company specifically, but there's like lots of recalls on airbags.
Oh. Those guys, I don't know if that's changing styles. Anybody else know what I'm talking about here? It's not that subtle, people.
Fashion.
Thank you. Fashion can be, so we have it in technology, we have it in fashion. And there are people that certainly criticize that. Intentionally holding back attractive functional features, then introducing them later to make the old model obsolete. Again, cell phones come to mind easily there, but other electronics products as well. This was more appropriate when Steve Jobs was still alive, but some quotes from articles, The Futurist, why the iPhone reeks of planned obsolescence. Planned obsolescence versus design deterioration. Planned obsolescence induced insanity, or damn you, Steve Jobs, why must you torment me? So people do get upset and criticize marketers, businesses for this sort of thing. Now, interestingly, Europe often has a different view of these things. Legislation was passed in France that requires companies to tell the consumer the expected lifespan of a product. How long should you expect this to last? Gives the consumers information on which they can make a smart purchase and not be disappointed, not be surprised that their product is outdated at a particular point in time. Poor service to disadvantaged consumers, another issue of business marketing ethics. Disadvantaged consumers, poorer consumers, are served poorly when they're forced to shop in smaller stores where they pay more money than they would otherwise, often for goods that are not up to the standards that you would have at national chains. So a national grocery store decides they aren't going to open in your area. This leads to the idea of food deserts, which maybe you've heard of perhaps in society. What does anybody know the set of companies that has opened up to help with food deserts and not having access to major stores in poorer areas and has had some criticism. Nada, 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 nada. The entire set of dollar stores that are often the only store around in an area sell goods that are, when you do a comparison on unit cost, more expensive than if it was a grocery store and arguably have inferior goods. See the criticisms of dollar store. Yes. Redlining by national chain stores occurs in disadvantaged neighborhoods. They just get a map out and they say, well, that's where these people live. We're not doing any business in there. It's seen by chain stores. It's seen by banks. It's seen by medical facilities, insurers. All these folks have been accused of unethical practices by not serving these folks. The poor are often targeted for rapid refunds, but fees start at something like $130. They have a 245% annual percentage rate, which doesn't seem like it should be legal. 10.6 million low-income families participated in this when I put this together with a $1.4 billion profit. Has been criticized in Ohio. Legislation has been proposed to stop it. It's still here. The argument is nobody, quote, nobody ever has a loan for a year. It's supposed to be short term, in and out. But in fact, lots of people get into these traps and the businesses know that's what's going on. Cultural pollution. Mass communication, as we know, is imprecise. So I'm trying to send this interesting message to you guys over here, and it spills out, and you guys get the message too. And you're upset by the message I'm trying to send to these guys because you don't like the message. But of course, this imprecise mass communication advertising helps to fund radio, television, magazines, newspapers, websites, social media platforms. So we pretty much need this communication, even though we know sometimes it spills out into other folks. Now, consumers can opt for technologies or media that reduce or eliminate ads. They can pay sometimes for that. And here is somebody that is very hep up about the terrible idea, and I know this is going to come as a surprise, that marketers use sex to get attention and sell products. And these folks are very upset about this.
We all know sex sells. It's used in commercials, in movies, in TV. But should sex be used to sell stuff to teenagers? New provocative ads for the acne cream Clearasil have parents really upset, including Mike Galanos. I'm a parent. I'm a little upset myself here too. This is tonight's Get to the Point segment. And boy, whew.
Let's face it, we work with some pretty open-minded people. Some of the words they used, appalling, disgusting, give you the creeps. We're talking about Clearasil here to help with teens with acne for years now. Well, they've got this May Cause Confidence campaign, a couple of racy ones. One of them here, we basically have a 16-year-old hitting on his friend's mom. Let's check it out.
Hi, guys.
Hey, I'm going to get my stuff. So, Miss Kelly, how are things? Everything good?
Yeah, thanks.
Must be lonely now that Mr. K left. I'm really good company.
Clearasil Ultra Treatment Cream.
All right, there you have it. I just don't get this. In this day and age when you've got teachers, we've done the stories, jumping in the sack with their students.
Absolutely.
Mary Kay Letourneau, we're bringing this. All right, joining me now from Washington to talk about this, Melissa Henson, she's with the Parents Television Council. She wants the ads off the air. We're going to get to her in a minute. Also from New York, Debbie Wolf, the co-founder of People Against Censorship. All right, Debbie. Like I said, I told you, we just mentioned some of the reactions. Mine is, it's disgusting. How are you supporting this ad?
It's not so much the ad that I'm supporting as the right to air it and being against people looking to pull things off the air. Our country is full of people with very different moral compasses, and for one group or even two groups to say you should listen to my moral compass instead of everybody else's concerns me. I thought the ads were funny. I thought they were over the top, and if you look at all three of them, so, I really don't see how you can't get the humor.
Okay.
But
yeah.
When you mention censorship like that, personally, I think an ad is worse than a show because the ad is like an ambush. I don't know it's coming. All of a sudden, 30 seconds later, before I can even grab the remote and change the dial, this has happened. Now I have to have a talk with my 12-year-old. What do you think of that?
I don't see how you can hold advertisers to a higher moral standard than you can to pop culture in general. When you have people looking at Britney Spears, looking at Paris Hilton, looking at everything that's on television, why is Clearasil held to a higher standard? Because they made a joke that you find offensive. It's funny. Do you really think Clearasil is advocating young boys to hit on their friends' mothers? I mean, that's just silly.
Granted, there is a humor in there, but what does my 15-year-old understand that? Let's show the next one. This one basically deals with a 16-year-old sex pot. Let's check this one out.
Here's her first tooth. Isn't she cute?
Yeah.
Oh, and here she is, naked in the bath. You should see me now. No. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right, who are the players here? Let's stay with you, Debbie, on this one real quick. Mom's a powerless buffoon. You got horny, awkward teen in the middle, and the girl's the sex bot. Do we really need to sex up our teens any more than they already are?
I don't know. I don't know where we got 16-year-olds, first of all. I don't see
she doesn't look much older than that, but go ahead. Make your point.
I'm not sure how we know that the boy is horny either. But you asked where the parents come in on this, or how does my daughter respond to this? How do my children respond to it? The response is because you as a parent are there, and you're watching this commercial, and you have an opportunity to explain to your children how they should react. If you look on the message boards that are attacking this ad, there are also people saying, my daughter, my son looked at that and thought that was awful. That's because they educated their children to the moral code that they are seeking. And that's how you deal with ads like this.
Well, I shouldn't be forced by Clearasil or anybody else to have this conversation when my son or daughter isn't ready. Let's get Melissa Henson in on this, again, with the Parents Television Council. Am I being overly sensitive or a prude on this one, Melissa?
No, I don't think you're being overly sensitive at all. I'm disturbed that this is part of a larger pattern of using sex. And, of course, we know that they've used sex to sell products for decades, generations. But this is, I think, part of a trend of using very overtly sexual imagery and messaging to target very young consumers. It's not just this. It's, you know, the Carl's Jr. hamburger ads advertising flat buns where they're, you know, teenage boys singing about their teachers. Posterior. And I think it's just all over the top, unnecessary, and I'm very disturbed by the fact that Clearasil's creative team can't think of a better way to promote confidence in young
girls
than
We wanted to get a representative from Clearasil. Yeah. Here's their statement. Want to let everybody know. It says, our objective is to inform and entertain, not to offend. We have found that Clearasil consumers see this ad as we intended, a humorous and unrealistic presentation of an awkward family event. I don't know many awkward family events like that, I think we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. This has been a good one. We appreciate it. Debbie Wolf with People Against Censorship and Melissa Henson with the Parents Television Council. Appreciate your time from both of you. And now we want to know what you think of this one. Do you think these ads are raunchy? Do you agree with me and think these are over the top, irresponsible at best? Or, hey, am I the prude here? Let us know. Email us, cnn.com/primenews. Click on the link. Email us. Video mail us, for that matter. Hey, they put me on TV. They might have put you on as well.
All right. Finally good. First of all, I agree with both positions, that's fine. Why Debbie needs to explain why a 15-year-old boy is horny, I'm not clear on why she doesn't understand that issue, but okay, Debbie. So, how many of you guys feel, and it's perfect, that this is really unnecessary? It's over the top. One, two, no more. Webby, three, two and a half, three Webbies, a couple of you. Unethical. It's unethical. Oh, more hands go up. It's unethical. How many of you feel that they are humorous? They're funny. Okay. So we come up with the question, should such ads simply be banned? They're in bad taste. They're unethical. We should just ban those kinds of ads. Get them off the air. How about censoring? Censor that we set up a board. They look at this stuff. They pass judgment on some sort of moral ethical principle. Yeah, we should censor these things. Are you waving? No, you're just writing. All right. Or should the consumer's response be the main influence? What should consumers do if they find this offensive, unappealing, and they don't like it? What should they do? Stop buying the product and get on social media and blast Clearasil for it, okay? This, of course, would be my answer as to what should happen. You get, you know, boatload of problems when you start banning ads, start censoring things. We've been there in other domains. But if truly the culture doesn't like what you're doing, your consumer culture, of course there's spillover, sorry, but the Clearasil audience got it. Okay, what were you about to say?
I was gonna add that, like, you know, when you get, it's not gonna be the new norm anymore because of Spotify and everything, but there's still like CDs of like artist's album,
mm-hmm.
and they have the, I don't know what it's called exactly, but there's a little sticker that says like, hey, it's got
the adult
swearing in it.
The adult version, yeah, the uncensored
yeah,
version.
Yeah, I learned the hard way from back when I was.
Yep.
Those things.
It's and there, you know,
really
I have to be a little careful what I play in the classroom, especially with pop music, because I'm never sure what they're saying. You have to be a little cautious. Anyhow, Clearasil says, look, our objective is to inform and entertain, not to offend people. We found that Clearasil consumers, our target audience, see this the way we intended to. Sorry it spills over into the rest of society and you're upset. Our target audience finds it amusing. How many of you guys follow Mike Alvins? They do a little risque stuff over time. This might be getting a little dated, but hashtag Mike Alvins. There are over 500,000 photos on Instagram tagged hashtag Mike Alvins. Most are selfies of lean 20-somethings in their beds and bathroom mirrors, proudly united by cotton underwear bearing the name Calvin Klein. These are unpaid, authentic posts that endorse the brand, and they're an extremely powerful way to interact with young people. They're far more effective than the more obviously paid for influencer posts or for a printed ad. But some people are gonna find this offensive. People are posing in their undies? Oh no.
Hi, I'm Heidi Zak, CEO and co-founder of Third Love. But more than that, I'm a strong and powerful woman and proud of it. I believe that women can do anything without limitation and that we aren't defined by our underwear. I'm personally offended by the Calvin Klein billboard ad in New York City that highlights a dated gender stereotype, that men are the breadwinners while women are sex objects. Women not only deserve respect, we demand it. The women of New York and women everywhere join me in saying we are no longer accepting this antiquated stereotype, and instead are creating our own gender definitions, that a woman can be anything she wants to be.
I'm just wondering if you take a look at that billboard there, if you could give us your thoughts and reaction.
It's terrible, and it's offensive. I'm not happy about it, and I won't give Calvin Klein my money.
Bingo, there you go. If you find it offensive, I agree, don't give the company your money. And if enough people don't give the company their money, guess what they'll stop doing? Whatever it is you find offensive. Your vision may vary. But if consumers don't agree, they shouldn't buy the products. If they don't buy the products, companies will stop doing it. Okay, if you're at home and your little toddler, well, not toddler, they won't know what's going on, and your little kid is nearby, and you and he or she are sensitive to strong caution material, walk them out of the room. If you're sensitive to strong to touchy material, close your eyes for this next one. But this is another ad that got a lot of controversy. I flash in my hashtag Calvins, okay? This is a takeoff on the distasteful porn stuff called upskirting. And here we have comments, you've crossed a line. This is tasteless, another exponent of the vorgasm Uber trend. Now, the comment here is that a peek up actress Clara Christina's skirt to glimpse her CK panties is not kiddie porn. It's sexy, and sex sells, duh. And Clara isn't 15. No one knows how to sell underwear and fragrances and clothing by promoting scandalous sex better than Calvin Klein. Every erotically charged fashion ad post-Calvin Klein's golden era in the 70s and 80s owes everything to that brand from Tom Ford and his infamously steamy and near-naked Gucci campaigns to Dolce & Gabbana's oiled-up men in Speedos. So, not everybody agrees with it, but it's certainly in pop culture. Sex sells. That's why they continue to do it. So why do they do it? Well, it gets results. The hashtag MyCalvins campaign led to significant growth on Calvin Klein's social platforms. Since the, again, older news, but still, the February 2014 launch, it's bulked up its Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter followings by 2.2 million, 1.8 million, and 1 million respectively. You may not think it's cool, but a whole bunch of people do that are arguably interested in the brand. Facebook currently has over 1.3 million followers, Twitter 1.7, and Calvin, I got sidetracked here by seeing what the current count is. Do you have a count? So 13 million like it, 14 million follow it, it being Calvin Klein's Facebook. So these numbers are still pretty good. So there's a misstatement there somehow. But a whole bunch more on these other sites. It reached a global audience, surpassing 469 million fans, yielding 23.5 million fan interactions. In July 2014, the brand expanded its advertising to Tinder. As Chief Marketing Officer Melissa Goldie explained, the platform is authentic and true to how this consumer communicates. As direct results of the Bieber campaign, Calvin Klein benefited from 3.6 million additional followers across its social channel. Sex sells, and as long as people buy into it, they're going to continue using it to get attention. Do they use other things? Sure, but this is one tool in their toolkit. In 2021, while the fashion industry in general, and Calvin Klein in particular, usually markets by being outrageous, PJ Lang and Calvin Klein opts for relatability, another approach. In one especially comical video, Travis Bennett promotes his favorite CK jeans without said jeans on. It's an oddball approach, and we've seen Calvin Klein ads push many boundaries, but never quite like this. Dave called me and had the ideas. We bounced back and forth, Bennett tells us. PG Lang, to me, is creating with no boundaries, as cliche as it may sound. This is what they did. Is there sound here? Yo, what's good? Where's my sound? No sound? Yeah, I'm trying. There, I'll scroll down over here. Thank you.
I could look better considering how much they pay me for it, but I mean, dude, I'm gonna take home the money and what they gonna do, beat me up? I could have given a little more time and effort, but I mean, you know, I'm a little last minute with everything, so. Did I blow it? No, I didn't blow it. No, I mean, I put a lot of me into it. I think when you see it, you'll notice that it's a lot of taco touch on there. A shout out on here? Okay, wait. I should know this. What's your last name again? Okay. Getting mad at me isn't going to help this. So what is your last name?
So, another approach to get attention in a different way. Now, let's move over to a different ethical position. How about let's talk a bit about being socially responsible? We did, of course, talk last time about our friends over at Patagonia pushing the social responsibility limit, giving up your million-dollar company to the earth. PepsiCo Recycling, socially responsible marketing. At PepsiCo, we believe that there's an opportunity to change how the world produces, distributes, consumes, and disposes of foods and beverages in order to tackle the shared challenges we face. We aim to use our scale, reach, expertise to help build a more sustainable food system, one that can meet human needs for nutrition and enjoyment and continue to drive economic and social development without exceeding the national boundaries of the planet. As well as being good for our business, our work, working to realize this purpose is also the right thing to do. So we're talking about, page is gone, we're talking about doing well while doing good. The recycling program, the U.S. is recycling less than half its bottles and cans. PepsiCo believes that a bigger challenge change starts with one bottle, with one person, with one action. You shouldn't mow just half of your lawn or groom half of your dog. Why not give 100% to recycling now? Be socially responsible.
You wouldn't do something halfway, would you? U.S., we're recycling less than 50% of our bottles and cans. Join PepsiCo in the recycling of every last bottle and can.
Simple acts start here. So what is management's general response to the need to be ethical? We start off the two lectures ago talking about how people didn't think it was necessary, but they do respond. One approach is to set an appropriate overall corporate culture dealing with these issues. At Avita, we say, look, our mission at Avita is to care for the world we live in, from the products we make to the ways in which we give back to society. At Avita, we strive to set an example for environmental leadership and responsibility, not just in the world of beauty, but around the world. That should, as a mission, and we talked about mission driving values, driving decisions, driving strategies and tactics, that should set the tone for this company, workers at the company. So setting the tone at the corporate area. We set codes of ethics. What I say in response to managers who tell me, I can't control what people think. I can't control whether or not they're thinking ethics. You're right. I can't control as an employee what you think. But you know what I can control? What you do. Here's our code. Here's how you need to behave in your decision making on the job and interacting with customers. I don't care what you think in some sense. But in your actions, I can manage you. And when you don't fulfill what our standards are, go work somewhere else. So we have companies that have codes of ethics that are intended to help their employees to think how to behave. Living our values every day, Kraft Heinz conducts business in an ethical manner, guided by the enduring principles of our founders and unwavering commitment to integrity. And you can read through their code of ethics on how to behave as employees, how to report a concern, and how their suppliers should behave as well. Behavior of top management, again, it starts at the top. You can't be sleazeballs at the top and expect your employees to be well-behaved, ethical people. Have an ombudsman for ethics. An ombudsman is, of course, somebody who is an impartial entity who's willing and able and approved to deal anonymously with complaints, concerns, whistleblowers, perhaps investigate, and decide whether or not there's an issue that has to be dealt with. But you have somewhere to go to. That's how serious we are. By the way, do you know that we have a student ombuds? Yeah? Nobody else knows about our student ombuds? Two people know about student ombuds. So if you feel that a professor is behaving unethically towards you, downgrading you because of something that they don't like about you unfairly, you head off to the student ombuds, file a complaint, it turns the whole system in. So we try to deal with that ethics in that way. So managing the ethical environment of your firm and its employees is a way to help your company be ethical.
Very important to us. You know, if you don't have the ethics and you know, abide by those, it's hard for me, number one, to trust you and hire you. That's first and foremost. It's all about trust. So, you know, we have a lot of belief in our people. We believe in them. You know, unless they prove us wrong, just like, you know, I have children, like I mentioned, similar type situation. But, you know, we also believe we don't want to be deceptive in our pricing or advertising. We want to say, here's what we're doing and why, and be very upfront and honest. We don't want people coming back, you know, a year later or even 6 months later saying, hey, this isn't what you promised me, because you get into a lot of issues that way. I personally, coming from the telecommunications industry, saw a lot of the questionable ethical practices. Good example, one of the larger firms, MCI. You know, they had a great company. You know, we were competing head to head, and their growth rates were unbelievable, and we were getting bashed in the marketplace because of that at the time. We find out later, you know, some of the things they were doing, the numbers were inflated quite a bit, and that whole house of cards came tumbling down. That could happen anywhere. I think Sarbanes-Oxley, even though I'm not an accountant, nor do I want to be, I think that's helped out, you know, accountability, you know, processes and following that and the audits that go with that. So it's defined a lot of things that weren't there before. So that's helped out, but I'm going to be honest. Ethics starts at the top and works its way down. If you're CEO, a vice president, it works its way down. If they're not ethical, that's the type of people they're going to hire. If they're ethical and they abide by standards and they adhere to those standards, I think that's where it starts, right there.
Works for me. Anybody an accountant who knows what Sarbanes-Oxley in general terms is or refers to? Accounting types? Nope. So as a result of these CEOs saying about illegal activity in the accounting side and the finance, I didn't know about that. Don't blame me. Blame them. The law now says, no. You're audited. You read the audit. You sign the audit. You are personally responsible for what the audit says. Sarbanes-Oxley, a rule that came in as a result of some of this nonsense behavior. So ethics begins at the top all the way down to me hiring ethical people. Fred Hunt talking about what his view of how this works at Sherwin-Williams.
Now the question of ethics in business today. I have a very long military background as well as many years in industry. And it's been my experience that comes to speaking about ethics, it all starts at the top. It really does. In the case of Sherwin-Williams, we have an excellent executive staff who absolutely live by the ethics that you would expect and exceed that. Just an exemplary group of folks and push that those thoughts through every corner of the organization. I've yet to meet anyone in a position of decision making in this organization that made a decision that I felt at all uncomfortable with, nor would they even broach it. I mean, it just is a phenomenal place to be.
That makes it nice.
Indeed. And the question of ethics in business today.
Okay, Fred. Cool. So there's the write-up. Anybody, you don't need to tell me the details of the company, but has anybody worked for a company where you know these folks are not ethical? Has anybody had that miserable experience? Yeah? So were you proud to go in every day to work and interact with these people and looking forward to your next experience? No. I mean, it's not good for whoever's being cheated. It's not good for the people that work there. You're unhappy, of course. It's not a good place to work. You resent it. If, of course, you have any ethics yourself, not a good working environment. So it's a phenomenal place to work because you know from the top down these people are going to behave fairly, treat you fairly, and treat your customers, partners, etc. appropriately. So good ethics is good business. Now this is slide's been around for a while. Patagonia was doing sustainable before most companies even knew what that meant, and now the brand is benefiting in interesting ways before they sold the company to the earth or gave it to the earth. Patagonia lately has been urging its outdoorsy customers to, quote, buy less and question whether they really need that several hundred dollar new parka even from Patagonia. The messaging has been suggesting that they should just repair and keep that $700 Patagonia parka instead of buying new ones. Interestingly, people responded, Patagonia's fans and customers are both joining the brand's sustainability cause and buying more new parkas from Patagonia. Sales increased almost one-third to $543 million, whatever year this was, which included about 9 months of the Buy Less marketing campaign. So you can do good, do well while you're doing good, however you want to think about it. Patagonia founder Yvonne Chouinard, who we just heard from the other day, I know it sounds crazy, but every time I've made a decision that's the best for the planet, I've made money. Our customers know that. And they want to be part of that environmental commitment. Nice job. Nice target audience. Good for them. Social responsibility. Accenture Strategy Global Consumer Pulse Research revealed that consumers across all generations care about what retailers say and how they act. Consumers under 30, those belonging to Gen Z and millennial generations, feel a strong affiliation to retailers that subscribe to a larger purpose, according to the research. More than 6 in 10 younger consumers closely consider a company's ethical values and authenticity before buying their products. It's a brand's responsibility to discover the topics that their target audience cares about. Retailers have to understand their consumers, their buying habits, demographics, behavioral patterns, This is just another layer of understanding about the consumer, what topics their consumers care about. For instance, Accenture's research found that companies that reduce plastics are more appealing to the baby boomer generation, 55 to 74 year olds. Millennials and Gen Zers felt strongly about social mobility, immigration, and poverty. What does your target audience care about in this domain that's consistent with your mission that you can make happen? So, good ethics is good for business. It's good for your shareholders. They know you aren't lying about your sales, about your finances, about your revenues. You're being honest. It's good for your employees. They feel like you aren't going to stab them in their back, their backs, that you aren't going to cheat them. It's good for your business partners, same reasons. For customers and clients, they're going to get a good product that has value. And it builds the idea in society at large that ethics is a good thing. So it's a win-win-win proposition. American Marketing Association is our professional organization, and almost all of your majors have professional organizations. We say the American Marketing Association commits itself to promoting the highest standard of professional ethical norms and values for its members, practitioners, academics, and students. It goes on a bit. As a result of what happened with the Black Lives Matter movement, we had a special statement from CEO Russ Klein over at AMA. It's not a time for passivity. Positive intentions, altruistic motives, and empathetic sentiments are not enough. The AMA is confronting the insidious rot of racism in our society head on. We can do more, be better, and be held accountable for turning tomorrow's hope into today's action. A change management expert once taught him that change only occurs when there's a committed leadership and universal dissatisfaction with the current state. Effective communication and adoption of dissatisfaction often begin with the dramatic declarations that we are universally fed up with the status quo. Everyone in the marketing community deserves voice and influence with respect to the AMA. Help us. We expect to hear the uncomfortable, but for all of us, we've had it with the slow progress of racial equality and equity. The urgent and acute need to meet this moment of such hurtful racism and generational damage is our number one priority. Black Lives Matter. So, AMA's ethics statement, as marketers, we must do no harm, foster trust in the marketing system, embrace ethical values such as honesty, responsibility, fairness, respect, transparency, citizenship. We expect AMA members to be courageous and proactive in leading and or aiding their organizations in the fulfillment of what I just said. Be really nice if we all were good people with good intention doing good things. All of this would come naturally. There are bad people everywhere doing bad things, and all we can do is talk to you about doing good things. All right, so that is the end of my discussion on marketing and ethics, chapter 4. We've been talking a lot about the consumer, the importance of understanding the consumer. Clearly, if we're going to satisfy consumers' needs, wants, and values at a profit through an integrated effort of the firm, we have to know a lot about these folks. So we are now in chapter 5, lesson is page 74, thinking about understanding our consumer. Whoa, that was a little enthusiastic. What the heck? Let's try that. Are you there? All right. So, we're back in our framework for strategic marketing management. We're thinking perhaps about assessing marketing opportunities. And in order to do that, we have to understand our consumer to see what those opportunities are. This is the B2C side. Presently, we'll talk about understanding organizations as consumers in the next chapter, the B2B side. Okay? So here's Michelle Skin. If you call Michelle, is working on the nonprofit side. She's a fundraiser for a hospital. She's thinking a little bit about her clients, customers, donors, and understanding them.
From the nonprofit standpoint, marketing is a little bit different. For what I do, marketing is, number one, learning the motivation of my donor. And quite honestly, I don't think that you can market a product or a service without understanding and learning the motivation of your donor. And I think that that's above the price, promotion, place, maybe not product, but certainly understanding why that person would be interested in giving a donation or purchasing your car as opposed to one from General Motors. You have to understand the motivation, what gets people to do what they are going to do. And to me, it is understanding their motivation and then marketing what I do to that motivation.
And that's going to help to be successful. We talked previously a little bit about thinking about why somebody would donate to a hospital, did we not? So one reason someone might donate is because the hospital saved a loved one and they want to donate in thanks. Somebody else may want to cure cancer. They have enough money, they're going to donate for that. Somebody wants status in their town. I'd like to have the Marks Maternity Ward to show what a great guy I am, caring about women's issues. Somebody else might want to, somebody in here brought it up, as I recall, donate for tax purposes, right? Charitable contributions come off my tax thing. If you are trying to raise money for this hospital, do you not need to understand the motivation of those different potential donors and market to them differently? Given the guy who wants to save money on his taxes, the Marks Maternity Memorial Wing, nah, he doesn't care. Tax information, oh, thank you very much. So what is the motivation of your consumer? Critical one to understand. What could they be? What does your target audience want?
Jeff, you started working at Macy's as a trainee 35 years ago, and now you're the CEO. You know, people dream about being the boss in charge of this iconic store. What's the key to your success?
You know, I'm a good listener, and I'm an avid learner. So just being a constant, perpetual learner and exposing myself to the brand the way the customer does is one of the secrets to my success. Wherever I'm going, my head is up. I'm looking at pop culture. What can I learn? What is the consumer digesting? What website should I be going to? I have a reverse mentor that is helping me learn about what the Gen Z customer is doing.
I do hear that you're very curious and that you ask lots of questions. Is there one question that you just keep asking over and over again everywhere you go?
What does the customer think? What's the customer reaction? She'll tell you. When I walk a store, I go to those associates, and you just ask them, what is the customer saying, and they will tell you. And you learn so much behind the strategy, where it came apart, where you didn't execute it right, what the need is. And our entire team of executives really are more focused on that frontline colleague than ever. You know, the customer is king on this, and we've got that frontline colleague that understands the customer better than any of us. So when she tells us what she needs and what she wants, those are marching orders. So when I bring that back to the store, I plug it in, and the organization responds.
Described as a pragmatic innovator. What does that mean?
You know, I think what's important about innovation is it's not a shiny penny. You've got to find something that actually can be bolted into the business that is serving the strategy that you've decided on. And ultimately, is it additive to the customer experience? So that's probably, you know, when you think about innovation and practicality, I want to make sure at the end of the day, does the customer value this? Is it going to drive shareholder value? Is it the right investment for us to make?
So a couple of cool things here from Jeffrey Gannett. For example, seeing the brand the way the customer does. But what is that customer being influenced by? The crest factors outside of us, including things like pop culture. What are they generally digesting? We have to understand those things. What websites are they on? What is Gen Z doing? Talking to that frontline employee who touches the customer every day. The customer is king. We have to respond to that. And when we do things like innovate, we can't just do it to innovate. We have to do it to serve our strategy. Why? To do something else we talked about, to add to that customer experience, something that they value. So what does the customer need, want, and value? What motivates the customer? We need to understand consumer behavior. And of course, these days, we need to understand it as COVID affects them as well. So we're going to think about the consumer through this somewhat elaborate model, but it also emphasizes how difficult it is to understand the consumer. I've highlighted one thing here because we were just talking about it, that's motives. But let me make the point that this model has five types of things we have to think about. We have to think about input variables and their influence on the consumer, like advertising, stimuli. We have to think about understanding how that consumer processes that Clearasil ad, that Calvin Klein ad. So we have to think about information processing as a second set of variables. We have to think about the decision process itself that leads to a choice of our product or not, influenced by decision process variables, and then a series of external influences outside the consumer, but which we must understand as well. So this is the adapted model of somebody called Engel, Colton, Blackwell, and it'll be what we use as we think about understanding consumer behavior. So let's start at the center with understanding the consumer's decision process. Decision process to do what? Either buy or not buy our product. Seems like that might be important for us to know about. So the first stage, I assume that you don't go out and buy things willy-nilly, randomly, without any thought, and you buy things you don't need, even in a teeny sense, need. So the first thing is consumers recognize they have a problem. They need something that they don't have, so they perceive a need. How's that work for your customer? Second of all, they search for a solution. Now, that can be a very simple search. You're standing in front of the candy machine. You decide you want a candy bar, and you choose one, okay? It's not a huge search. You go to buy a new car. You're going to buy an EV for the first time. I don't know anything about EVs, about batteries, about maintenance, about reputation. I got to do a massive search. But you look for value. Then you come up with some alternatives and you begin to judge them. You begin to evaluate them on some criteria that are important to you. So we talk about assessing value. Presumably this leads to your choice to buy some brand to solve your problem. So we are buying value. And then there is some kind of outcome here. Some level of satisfaction as you use the product. And what are you asking yourself? Did it do what I needed it to do? Does it solve my problem? Does it give me the value I expected or not? And we in marketing have to understand all of those things. And that's just the center part of the model. But that's as far as I'm going to get today because we're about out of time. See you next time. Have a good weekend.